Greetings, and welcome back to the Rose Bros Podcast. This episode, we are joined by Shubham Garg, CEO and founder of White Thunder Investments. Shubham graduated from the University of Alberta with a Bachelor of Science degree in engineering and has combined his hands-on experience into White Thunder Investments, a mid-seven-figure portfolio focused on undervalued Canadian energy companies. White Thunder is also Shubham's next step in sharing his knowledge and simplifying energy investing in order to attract more interest in the sector. We sat down and, among other things, discussed fund performance, the difference between financial and physical oil markets, recent M&A activity in Canadian energy, echo chambers, and how credit risk is impacting energy markets. Enjoy. This podcast episode is sponsored by Conate Water Solutions. Do you need cost-effective water sourcing options to supply your next drilling or completions program? Conate Water Solutions is a specialized hydrogeology company focused on water well drilling, testing, and water management services in Western Canada and Texas. Contact info at conatewater.com or check out conatewater.com for more details. This podcast is sponsored by headracingcanada.com. Looking for high-performance ski gear this winter? In partnership with four-time Olympian Manny Osborne Parody, headracingcanada.com is offering the lowest prices possible through its online storefront by passing brick-and-mortar savings on to customers. Check out headracingcanada.com for more info and get your high-performance ski gear for the upcoming season. If you're good, we'll start.
You betcha. You got her.
Shubham Garg, good morning. Thank you very much for doing this again.
You betcha. No, good to be here.
This is our second conversation. First one was last year. Today, I think we'll go through things, kind of current events on energy. For the listener, you are the CEO of White Thunder Investments. But to remind anyone listening, what is White Thunder Investments?
Yeah, you bet. So White Thunder started off as kind of my own investment way to invest in Canadian oil and gas and provide some education back to some of the newer investors in the industry. Still continuing on with my Sunday sessions. So we do every Sunday or every second Sunday go through in-depth company valuations, which now for listeners who listened to the last podcast, now in 2023, I've shifted it more from company-specific valuations to kind of what I would call macro topics and petroleum engineering topics. So really try to have some information out there on how these wells work, what sort of parameters go into drilling a well, the different global areas of supply demand. So really moved my educational part of White Thunder into that. And then on the investment side, still continuing on with our investments in the public markets in Canadian oil and gas. But once again, for the listeners who were at the last podcast, 2023, I've really shifted my investment strategy into some of the more junior companies. So we are moving down market per se. And I think we'll get into this here as we go on. But I do think the risk that is in some of these smaller companies is overstated by a lot of the people looking at these companies. So I'm happy to kind of jump in where there is a little void in the market. And as part of that, we're participating and creating our own private placements into companies that need capital at a time where capital is really, really hard to find. So we go in and we say, look, we're going to come in not just as investors, we're going to come in as investors. And we have our own engineering sort of team between myself and a couple of my close connections. And then we also have a, call it business development side that we can bring to these companies by sharing their story in a proper way, in a technical way, and then also by sharing the vision that the company has and how that can be accomplished. So that's kind of where White Thunder is right now. And I'm a pretty go with the flow guy. So depending on how sort of the year goes, it's a very dynamic, adjustable sort of entity per se. And yeah, really, really glad to have the support of everybody. And it's been a fantastic ride. So just hope to keep on keeping on and bring some energy back to oil and gas, which has been in the dumps for quite a few years now.
If I'm correct, 2022 was a great year for White Thunder. Returns were very good.
Yeah, 2022 was fantastic. I think 2022 will be remembered as a tale of two distinct halves. There was the first half of the year where nothing could go wrong. It seemed like every day you woke up and it was green. Just this almost euphoric time that happened and lots of money was made. I think some of us got a bit too carried away with that, myself included. We saw what was beginning to be a very ultra super cycle. And then I think rightfully so, the US government stepped in and said, hey, you know, we need to kind of cool things down a bit, which created the second half downdraft. But at the same time, you know, when you really look into it, it's really only the latter part of June and maybe the early part of July that were really a steep drawdown. Because after that, the XLE, the index, some of the companies performed really, really well. So even the performance from like July 15th to the end of the year was not that bad at all, especially when you compare it to a broad market that got absolutely shellacked last year. Mm-hmm. I think there's at the end of the day, the XLE was about almost, I want to say 70, 80, 90% outperformance versus the XLK technology index. So I think it was a great year for everybody who had a majority energy portfolio last year. And really the interesting thing to me is we were able to make those gains after what was a life-changing 2021 for a lot of people. So you were able to take that money, reallocate it, and then make another 50, 75, 100% off that in 2022, which is really interesting because investors have gone divided at this point where we are today into two different camps. There's a camp that has all this, call it house money, that they're playing with. So they're not as sensitive. They're not as emotional. Mm-hmm. And then there's this new breed of investors who came in at some point in 2022 who haven't quite seen that same phenomenal gain, at least not sustained for the last little bit. And so there's a bit of frustration. There's a bit of, call it, sensitivity there, that when oil hits in the six handle as it did yesterday, mm-hmm. Some of that comes out and there's kind of a difference of opinion as to where we are, which I think is something that the oil industry has always suffered with, this volatility and this difference in where people are. And I think the real answer will be told if 1, 2, 3, 5 years down the road as to who exactly made the best of the cycle. It's not something you can gauge over a 6-month period, yeah, or a 1-year period and say, hey, I'm the winner and he's the loser. You can't make those conclusions until kind of the cycle plays its part, which again, I think we'll get into this, but I think this cycle might be the longest cycle that we've ever seen, just given some of the supply-demand fundamentals that are at play and the political interference that has created some of the other issues underlying that moving forward.
Give the listener perspective and to celebrate White Tundra a little bit. I think I read you were up 100, maybe 200% over the year in 2022.
Yeah, I believe we were up 143% at the end of the year. Now, of course, that is with, we run about 30 to 50% margin on the portfolios and then also have a little bit of options exposure for sure. So yeah, up 143% last year. Yeah. So definitely, you know, some champagne was had over the last few weeks with friends and family and fellow investors, for sure.
The true definition of a successful investor, like you said, though, is over the long term. Do you have a kind of time horizon that you measure yourself against, say 5, 10 years?
For sure. Yeah. So I think it's less so about the number of years to me. It's more so about the cycle as it continues. And that creates a different definition for me in my head, because if we just zoom back a year from today, so we're looking at March 16th, 2022, I would have been having conversations with some of my fellow investors and saying, hey, this cycle could be over in 6 months because prices would just skyrocket. We don't have the supply to back it up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's just play out a scenario where, call it, China doesn't shut down as severely as they did. We have a scenario where Russian production falls off a little bit more than they did. We have a scenario where Libya, the Libyan civil war escalates to a massive point. And oil could have been $250 a barrel, you know, in last April, May, June. And we would sell everything and we just sit tight, wait for things to kind of cool down, which may or may not have happened, right? There's a million things that can happen in the oil industry just because there's so many major factors. And the cycle would have been over and we would be doing something else. So given where we are now and some of the changes that have happened in the last year, I think the cycle now is going to be a 5 to 7 year cycle, maybe even longer. And that that sort of confidence in the longevity of the cycle is what has given me the confidence to go and say, okay, I believe in these junior companies who they're not going to turn around the story in a month or three or six. It's going to be at least a 24-month sort of hold period on these, and possibly even longer. Because if oil prices are doing good, I don't mean way up there, but even $80 plus, $100 plus oil environment, these companies make so much cash flow that they can just reallocate that, you know, keep putting it into the drill bit. Given that they're junior companies, they don't really affect the global supply demand that much. But at the same time, it's giving me the confidence that, hey, I can go into these companies, I can let them allocate through the cycle, develop their properties, make some money, and hopefully reap rewards off that because of the risk we took. So that's kind of how I'm going to base myself off of is, okay, at the time that we exit our positions, what was the overall gain throughout the cycle? And, we can say the cycle started in May or June of 2020. The first part of the cycle was, I would say, call it June of 2020 to June 8th of 2022. That was the first part of the cycle. It was a largely momentum trade. Everybody made money. And then from June 8th onwards is the real test of who performed and who didn't. Because at this point, companies are differentiating themselves. Mm-hmm. Certain companies are doing better. And certain companies have really hit this death spiral of sorts, where it's just an exodus of investors going forward. That's either a problem or it's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. And depending on which side people take and at what time is going to depend on your portfolio performance, because things move very, very fast in the oil and gas industry. And you can make a lot of money by flipping in and out. You can also make a lot of money by just hanging tight and just sitting in your best winners and letting them ride. Call it a dynamic definition of performance. But really, I think a lot of oil and gas investors have done really, really well. And we're now at the point where we're starting the actual cycle with a lot more capital than maybe we would have expected. So I think it's also good to be, to take time and reflect at where we really are and just understand that this is not an opportunity that everybody has had over the last 2 years or that everybody is going to get over the next little bit. It's really a, call it once in a generation sort of thing that comes up. And I'm happy to be here for that at the right time.
Today is March 16th, 2023. Yesterday, oil fell into the 60s. In your opinion, why are we down in the 60s now? What is happening to drive the price lower?
Yeah, so one of the biggest issues is that the physical market is not tight. So what happened in Q3, Q4 of 2022, primarily I'm talking about the absolutely restrictive Chinese lockdowns is the one major factor. On the other side, you have the Russian barrels that never fell off the market, at least for now, until today, you can say. So because these two factors were part of the speculation that was occurring in, call it Q2 of 2022, it pushed prices higher. There was this belief that, okay, we're going to be in this tight market going forward. And we still are in a relatively tight oil and gas market. But the reality is the physical barrel is not tight because of the SPR release, because of the fact that Russian barrels never fell off the market, and because of the fact that China was a kind of a muted buyer at least until October, November, you can say, until that time frame. So because these things happened, what takes over is that the speculation leaves the market, the excess, call it bullish pressure, leaves the market, and the buyer just says, hey, why should I speculate on this when I can just wait and watch and see what happens? And they've been completely right so far, because oil has in fact come down as opposed to even going up further. So the paper market is in control right now. The open interests are lower, which creates this liquidity gap where, hey, if a small player starts dumping barrels on the market, you see this $3 to $4 to $5 move that goes down in, 30 minutes, an hour, and just bizarre sort of price action around that. So the question is, what does it take to fix it? And really what it takes is the physical tightness in the market. And that physical tightness could come from various factors. I think China is the biggest factor at this point. The reopening has been what I would term a slow burn. So it's happening behind the scenes as much as it is happening, you know, on the main sort of show floor. So when I track some of my, call it parameters, I see, okay, Hong Kong is starting new flights to this. Australia is doing this. China just yesterday announced they are now opening the visas to all foreign tourists once again after 3 years of not having that. So these things in a 1.4 billion people country takes time to play out. 30% of the Chinese, call it individuals, had their passports expire over COVID. So now there's this lag time that's in various parts of that reopening boom that's going to play out as the year goes on. And the expectation is, of course, that as the year goes on, that's going to create this physical tightness in the market as the demand picks up all over. So why are we in the 60s? Because the physical market is not tight. We're seeing the paper market really take over. Mm-hmm. But when we look at it from my perspective, there's a secondary knock-on effect on this, where the longer we stay sub $75, $80, $85, $90 a barrel, supply it continues to drop. And guess what? When oil is cheap, people use it more. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like this dynamic effect where the longer we stay here, the higher the values are on the other side, and the longer we can sustain there, because it's not a video game where, oh, oil's $100, we can now bring on 3 billion barrels of supply. No, there's a long kind of lag to that, which is probably now going to be even longer because nobody trusts the US government to not dump another hundreds of millions of barrels of SPR on the market. So there's a mindset shift that's becoming more and more entrenched. And once again, it plays into why I've chosen to kind of reshift my portfolio allocation, because I feel confident in a more longer term period, as opposed to, okay, what's happening this week or next week. And, you know, at the same time, it's an interesting psychological mm-hmm. experiment, because I wonder how many people are going to leave the trade for good here and just say, hey, I'm happy with my gains, I'm happy with whatever, or they've ended up losing money over the last few months and they kind of sit out on the sidelines, and then whatever happens on the other side, as you know, my views on that, heavily biased views, but backed up by data, of course, you know, we're obviously betting on a higher for longer cycle, which seems to be getting higher and seems to be getting longer the more time we stay in this environment. Because, yeah, like I said, rigs are being dropped, frac fleets are being dropped, projects are being canceled, things are being pushed back, and projects are not getting FID'd. It's just a knock-on effect that compounds with sort of time as a variable, which everything takes time in the oil and gas industry, right? Nothing is today. What is certain, I can tell you, is 100 million barrels of oil disappear into thin air every single day, never to be seen again. So that's the physical and geological reality of oil.
To the listener, it's a bit technical, but what is the difference between the financial market and the physical market for oil?
Yeah, you bet. So the physical market really is the barrel that's consumed. So we say, okay, X amount of barrels are being consumed of this product, or X amount of barrels are being consumed of this in this industry. And really, so let me just back up a sec. Crude is bought by the refiners. The individuals or the consumer consumes products. So when we look at the market for crude and where crude prices are, you got to look at what are the refineries buying, because they're the only users of sort of raw crude to begin with. So there has been a slowdown in the refining kind of space over the last couple of years. For the first time in decades, we're seeing that refining capacity went down in 2021 and even some parts of 2022. So being that refiners are the buyers of crude, there's this once again, a lack of physical buying in the market because the refineries have been shutting down. That is now turning a corner where you see new refineries in Mexico. Kuwait's Al Zour just fired up a 615,000 barrel per day refinery. You're seeing new refining in China and then in the, call it, Asian market as well. Right now, you have about 900,000 barrels per day of refining down in France because of the strikes. So once again, when you have these singular events, it once again creates less buying on the margin. And what I mean by on the margin is crude is priced at the last barrel bought. So when you have 100 million barrels being produced, you have 100 million barrels being bought. If there's an extra 200,000 or 500,000 that needs to be bought, that barrel is what prices the market, because that's your extra barrel you're trying to squeeze out of the producers. So we're sort of in this very tight range. So that's your physical barrel, is who's actually buying that crude to load onto ships or pipelines and bring it to the refinery. The paper market is your financial market, which is 10, 15, 20 times the size of the physical market. Speculators and banks and even the companies themselves, when they hedge against the future production, you have buyers, you got traders, you got all sorts of entities in the market looking to squeeze out money. And for them, it's all about making money. They don't care about the long-term health of the industry. They don't care about the supply-demand dynamics. It's all about how can I squeeze out the most money right now? And really, when the physical market is not tight, they have more reason to go and say, okay, I can play the paper market knowing that if something happens and I get caught, I have this excess physical crude to actually deliver on those contracts. And they're feeling safe right there. And what you saw happen last year was that physical market got really, really tight.
The opposite.
The speculators left the market and everything just skyrocketed. So almost too much to the upside, you could say, at this point. So that's really the difference. The one thing that's different when people talk about paper markets are always going to be in control. Paper markets is always the right price and whatnot. The only difference is in the case of metals, which the paper markets have been in control for decades, is that metals can be recycled. Metals are in storage all over the place. They don't just disappear. Whereas oil, once it's consumed, is gone. So there's a real physical loss of supply or inventory that's happening every single day. So when the physical market gets tight, you can't just go into some vault somewhere and pick up more metal or recycle something. You literally need to find the oil that the world is consuming and they will pay for it. So that's what I'm looking for this year. Maybe this quarter, maybe as soon as kind of next month, as time goes on, we do want to see a physical tightness again. Are there signs of that? I don't think quite yet, but as sort of the world reopens, Asia especially, I'm really watching Asian international jet fuel demand as sort of my proxy as to when the market gets tighter. And then supply on the other side, right? People take supply for granted. They say, oh, we're producing this and this is what it is. Well, you don't know that. Tomorrow, there could be another civil war in Libya. There could be another attack by Iran or Israel. There could be another issue in Russia. There's supply is never constant. And one of the big places to watch it along with those is the US, where shale production is not looking all that great. Rigs are dropping, frac fleets are dropping, production's dropping, well productivity is going down. And it's this sort of accelerated cliff pattern that is going to develop, I think, over the next even 3 to 6 months. And we'll see how well shale can do to kind of keep up supply going forward.
As an investor, you make a lot of your decisions based on the data that gauges where supply demand is at in terms of oil production, physical demand, financial paper markets, and all that. But the criticism, a lot of the data is that it's not accurate a lot of the time or it's wrong. How do you know that the data you're using is right? And in your experience, has it been right in the past? Is it reliable for you to make investment decisions?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. So I think there's two parts to this that really need to be maybe discussed. And the first part is the data accurate and reliable, right? And then I would also add in, if the data is accurate and reliable, does it really mean what we think, like we're interpreting off that? Mm-hmm. So I'll maybe talk about the first point first. The data has gotten a lot better, I'll say, in the last 5, 7, 10 years. We have really good data on inventory. So inventory is by definition the difference between supply and demand. So it's the only way to globally gauge what's happening. Okay, this is what's being produced. This is what's being consumed. And the inventory shift is the difference between that. So that I think it is quite reliable that we know whether we're in an undersupply on a month-to-month basis, whether we're in oversupply, or whether we're just flat. The unreliable data has to do with supply and demand in certain parts of the world. So when people say, okay, what is Chinese demand? Mm-hmm. We don't entirely know. But what I can tell you is Chinese inventory is this, and this is how much crude China imported, and this is how much crude China produced. If we have those numbers, you can say, okay, Chinese demand is this because the inventories fell X barrels. And that's really the extent to what we'll ever get. I think we'll never have a real-time demand number on anything because, I mean, think about it. You're talking about 8 billion people consuming every single day, and you're trying to track that. Unless we have those Elon Musk chips or something in our head that's recording everything, mm-hmm. maybe at some point in the future we can have that. But for now, I think inventory is very, very accurate. I think companies like Vortexa and Keros and Kepler do a really good job because not only do they have the physical tracking of crude, they have satellites tracking crude, they have live pictures. They also have relationships within customs agents at every single port that will tell them, hey, 1.345 million barrels of crude came in. It came in from the UAE. This is where we discharged it. So there is a lot more work being done on bringing a more comprehensive, accurate view as to what's happening, which is really what we need to really understand the oil markets. So the data is there. Some parts are more accurate. Some parts are more reliable. The only number that I would say, like, can almost guarantee is 100% correct is the inventory number. The supply and the demand are more models and sort of dynamics that go on. That being said, there is countries where the supply number is really, really good. For example, just as a exotic example, Ecuador tracks their crude production on a day-by-day basis from the national ministry, and they post it every single day. So as soon as there's a pipeline incident or another problem, you will know it within 24 hours. So there are certain blips of really good data, but on the overall, really, if a new investor is looking to track sort of global undersupply, oversupply, inventory is a number to look for. And that, in my opinion, is really, really accurate at this point. Now, what does it mean? And I think this is one of the issues that we get into where over the last 12 to 18 months, the thesis has been, hey, if we're in an undersupply, prices should continue going up. It makes perfect sense. Okay, inventories are dropping. We don't have enough supply. Demand is continuing to rise. Prices should go up. But it doesn't exactly work that way because of the physical barrel. When the US dumped 225 million barrels of call it strategic crude onto the commercial market last year, they artificially fixed that undersupply. So even though global crude and products was declining, we didn't really have a physical barrel tightness. And if we don't have a physical barrel tightness and crude is priced on the margin, we saw prices that were unable to sustain kind of where they should have without the SPR. Now, the other counterpoint to that is, hey, crude still averaged $95 a barrel in 2022 with, you know, Russian barrels still on the market, with the world's second biggest economy in a sustained lockdown, with the Fed raising rates from 0% to 3, 4, 5%, with the dollar index at 115 it had got to late last year, and crude was still $80, $85, $90 a barrel. So there was a bit of physical tightness sustained throughout last year. There was a bit of speculation sustained throughout last year. And then it seemed like November, December, that entire bubble just burst. And, well, I should be careful. It's not a bubble. It's just how the market was. It burst because of, I think, the Chinese lockdown got extremely intense just before their party congress. And they stopped buying on the market. And all of a sudden, the physical market got weak. And now we're sort of getting back into it, trying to get our mojo back. And I think the biggest factor this year to watch is Asian international jet fuel. That is one that people are counting out. They think, well, it's just China. China's doing this, China's doing that. Well, flights to Australia are 70% of pre-COVID levels. Flights to Indonesia are 60% of pre-COVID levels. flights to Hong Kong are about 25 to 50% of pre-COVID levels. There's a lot of countries in that region depend on China to reopen the manufacturing, the petrochemicals, the real estate, the steel, the mining, all of that. You know, it's a whole big area there that is slowly warming up. It's slowly firing up. And I think that is the one to watch going forward. And March 15th was a big day because a lot of flights opened up on March 15th. And then the Chinese visas started being issued again as of yesterday. And we'll kind of see how it plays out over the next couple of months. But we've got really good data on forward-looking jet schedules. And it's looking pretty good, especially where we are now. I think we should be careful not to forget the lower oil prices go, the more demand kicks on and the lower supply goes. So there's the underlying shift that happens. It's not just that everything is constant and the price just gyrates up and down. There's a real impact to it. And this is something I think that some of the US administration and some of the pontificators don't really understand is you can't have oil prices lower for longer because we don't have the supply. And you have to invest in supply, and people are not going to invest in supply until prices get higher. So there's a what's coming is going to come. It's just how strong it's going to be and how long it's going to be when we do end up in that regime of, call it, physical barrel tightness.
Jet fuel demand would be one metric you track. Storage levels would be another. Are there any other data points that you measure for anyone listening?
So I think jet fuel is relatively easy to track, I think, because there's various, call it, free websites that give you day-to-day, real-time number of flights that went yesterday and the day before and the day before that. It can split it into domestic flights. It can split it into international flights. You can split it by exact route taken, exact country of origin and whatnot. So it's a relatively easy one to track. The inventories are also relatively easy to track. The one mistake a lot of people make is looking at just US inventory, which gives you a skewed kind of metric, because ever since the US became an export market, there's a natural arbitrage between WTI, between Brent, between the Permian barrels, between the, what we call the MEH Houston barrels. So we really need global inventory, and we need inventory by product. So what I've seen happening over the last, call it, 6 to 12 months is we're losing our high-value products. So we're losing our gasoline, diesel, jet fuel. We're losing our crude. And what are we gaining is residual fuel oils, propanes, butanes. But when you look at inventory globally, hey, it was flat in the last 6 months. Yeah, but we lost the high-value products, and we ended up gaining inventory of these butanes and propanes and petrochemical feedstock and whatnot, which can't really be used for anything else. So I think when we look at inventory, we really need to look at inventory by country and then inventory by product as well. So that's one point. The other things that I would track, of course, are the US rigs, the number of rigs working in the US, the number of frac fleets working in the US, because there's a lag effect to that. If we drop 50 rigs in the last 6 months, that's going to show up in production 3 months from now. So 3 to 6 months from now. So I think watching the global rig count, watching the US rig count especially, and why I stress the US is because, I mean, since 2014, the US was 70% of the global supply add from 2014 to 2020 was the US. 70% of it was shale. So when that starts rolling over is really a really, really key indicator to watch. I would watch Russian exports. So how much crude is Russia exporting is another major factor. I would watch OPEC exports. So more specifically, UAE, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait. These are your five, call it, Gulf countries that control how much oil is being moved. They also control the prices to some extent through their OSPs that they put out every month. So that's more on the supply side. On the demand side, I would primarily this year track international jet fuel. I would track U.S. gasoline once again. We don't really have good numbers there. I think the accuracy of the EIA is getting even worse, which is a hard thing for me to say, given that the data itself was already very questionable. And now the adjustment factors and whatnot are rising even more, which again brings more questions to the validity of their data. But U.S. gasoline, you can track through, not through gasoline, but through vehicle miles traveled. So they publish vehicle miles traveled every single month, and you can use that as a proxy for overall travel. Of course, EVs have made some dent in that, but in the U.S., EV penetration is not that high so far. So not a major factor. So that's more on the demand side is the things I would track. Of course, Chinese imports is another major one. How many ships and how much crude is entering China on a day-to-day basis? We have real-time tracking on that. So that's another factor I would track. And then inventories are just, you know, like I said before, by country and by product, and you have a really good idea as to what's happening. And for us in the oil and gas industry, unfortunately, we now have to track CPI reports, PPI reports, and these other factors, along with how many banks have failed today, as sort of another secondary data analysis, which is unfortunately more prevalent now than it ever was. Definitely tracking that closely as well, moving forward.
A lot of times macro issues are fun to track and interesting to watch, but they're not very informative. We like to paint narratives and draw conclusions from things that basically don't have an answer in very complex systems. Have you found the macro to be helpful in making your investment decisions? And if it is, how do you protect on the downside that it isn't helpful and that maybe your conclusions are, there's some room for error?
Yeah, for sure. So macro is good as your baseline. So what I mean by that is you're not always going to be correct in what your macro interpretation is. I think it's almost a fool's errand to try and be correct on your macro every single time, because there's so many other factors that could come out of nowhere, right? There could be a random alien invasion and then your macro goes out the window.
Yeah.
So there's just too many factors there. What I will say is a lot of investors, I see this myself because I talk to a lot of them, they play themselves. They confuse themselves into trying to hedge against every single a possibility and every single probability. What I would suggest, and this is not investment advice, this is how I do things, is have a view on the macro that is completely you are convinced of, and you have the data to back it up. And then you have some sort of thesis that goes because of the data. And then you invest accordingly based on that. So my thesis is, hey, we are in a structurally undersupplied market. When does that show up? Well, maybe today. Maybe it shows up in a month or three or six. What I'm saying is, no matter what we do, we don't have the oil to meet the world's growing demand. Mm-hmm. At some point, that's going to show up. And if you look at any oil cycle in the past, companies go up 200, 300, 500, 700% in those cycles. And that's what I'm betting on, that this is what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Now, I get other questions from people saying, hey, what if this happens? What if that happens? Will this company survive 6 months at 40 WTI? Mm-hmm. Will this company survive 6 months at this and that? And I say, there is no company that's going to survive 6 months at 40 WTI that also offers you the highest torque on the upside. You can't have it both ways. You have to make a decision on the macro, where you see things going, and then you allocate your portfolio accordingly. So that would be kind of my first point as to where how I use macro. And if I see some changes in the macro where, hey, you know, maybe there's a bunch of extra supply somewhere, maybe the demand hasn't really kicked on, that's when it's up to you to make a decision. Okay, does the oil price right now and the equity price right now reflect that already? Or is this something that the market doesn't see yet? And maybe it's time for me to exit and rebuy or whatever you want to do around that. So that's kind of up to you. What I've found in most cases, once the macro becomes clear that, hey, there's something wrong in your thesis, it's already too late. The price has already fallen to a point where it's already priced in, and now it doesn't make sense for you to sell because your thesis still holds just from a lower level and things being priced in. So that's kind of the first point that I'll make there. As far as how do I protect myself, I kind of use this example as not not a way to poke at people, but a way that I see things is, if you ask me, is this company going to survive 6 months at 50 WTI, let's say. Mm-hmm. Let's say you're trying to downside protect yourself for that case. My question to you is, if you think that that's a reasonable possibility, why not just sell everything? Why are you trying to protect yourself in those sorts of scenarios, which are going to wipe out a lot of your gains anyway? And in you trying to protect yourself against that over and over and over every single month, you're losing so much of your upside torque that just trim your positions less, hold less energy exposure is kind of the way that I would say that I downside protect. My margin today is 1/3 of what it was in June. So that's the way that I've naturally kind of brought myself to a more playing field that I feel comfortable with. If I see some sort of bullish sign in the underlying that hasn't been priced in, I just use my margin as my toggle towards my how comfortable I feel towards the industry. I also use my exposure to junior companies as a sort of toggle to how I feel towards the industry. I also use my exposure to the number of highly leveraged plays versus debt-free companies that I'm using as my toggle. So I've got sort of a different way of doing it. I don't buy any put options. I don't do any sort of collar spreads or anything, nor have I ever purchased WTI contracts, which a lot of people do. And hey, all the power to them. I'm not saying my way is correct. I'm saying it's the way that works for me because I have the luxury of being able to track things on a day-to-day-to-day basis. So I don't need to buy any sort of long-term protection on that. But you know, for sure, I would say the best downside protection is to have a more conviction in your trade. That's really what will give you not just financial sort of better portfolio allocation, it will give you better mental toughness as to what you're doing. Because if you're constantly second guessing yourself and saying, what if this happens? What if that happens? What if oil goes to zero again? And it's very hard to construct a portfolio for even the most established portfolio managers around that sort of clouded grayness in your view on where the world is headed. And if you do manage to construct a portfolio that allocates for that, your performance is going to be 3% a year, 4% a year. I would just buy bonds and just leave it there, right? So if you are going to be playing to hit home runs and hit grand slams, you're going to have to take some of the strikeouts that come with that. That's just the reality of it. And unfortunately, that's how the world works. If we had an easier way, everybody would be a billionaire and we'd be sitting flying around in our private jets, you know, but we don't. So that's kind of my, call it, half answer to that question, because I've never found a portfolio downside protection strategy that works for me without tapping the upside as well along with it so far. But yeah, I would suggest for anyone looking to enter the oil and gas industry, as far as investments, you're looking at it for the first time, or you're thinking about going bigger into it, before you ask yourself, what company should I buy? Before you ask me, what company should I buy? Before you ask Trevor, you know, what company should I buy? Tell me what your view on the macro is. What do you think is the highest probability chance of happening? Once you have that, it's a lot easier for me to say, okay, based on this scenario, I can say these companies are going to be the best sort of companies that do the best in this macro environment. If you come to me and say, hey, I believe in your thesis, I like the higher oil price, but I also want to protect myself, and I also don't want high debt, but I also want the highest performance, unfortunately, I can't help you, you know, with that sort of thing. Because if I could answer that question, I myself would be allocated accordingly to that.
If I'm correct, Warren Buffett was buying Occidental yesterday. He's a financial genius, but he obviously sees the long-term demand for oil going up and kind of that similar looking at things from a supply-demand viewpoint as well.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, you know, by no means would I use him as kind of the only thing to watch, but the fact that he's what now 22, 25% of Occidental. Mm-hmm. Again, it's not just oil that he's betting on with Occidental. It's a lot of the carbon credits and carbon capture as well. But he sees where the world is going. There's a reality of the world that is based on physics, chemistry, math, and geology. you know, these sorts of things, you can't just make up your own rules of science and say this is what's going to happen, because you're not going to be successful. You know, him buying is definitely a major plus for us sort of oil bull investors. The other thing that's similar but not quite is the fact that companies have stopped hedging. So from 2010 all the way to 2020, companies used to hedge a large part of their crude and gas exposure as a way of protecting the business. Now companies have stopped hedging, which tells you, okay, if I'm running an oil and gas company, what do I like? I like my salary. I like my bonus. I like my stock options. I like my performance options. What's the best way to protect these? Well, the best way to protect them is to make sure the company survives. And the best way to make that happen is to hedge every single barrel, right? And then you have no risk. If oil hits $30, you're still surviving. And the fact that companies have stopped hedging tells you that they feel, hey, we think the probabilistic model is that oil is going higher as opposed to lower, which is what we're going to be hedging into in a backwardated curve. So these sorts of side things that are happening, they're not discussed very often. It's just something that happens as time goes on, give you more confidence in the trade that the people who have the most to lose from not protecting themselves are choosing to not protect themselves, right? And then Warren Buffett goes out and buys what some would call a exorbitant amount of a multi-billion dollar oil company, is giving you even more confidence that, hey, you know, he believes in what's happening. The fact that he continues to buy, the fact that we continue to see insider buys within companies like Whitecap and Arc Resources and Baytex, you know, despite the price coming down, gives you more confidence, I think, in the trade, or it should anyways, from my perspective. They're not always correct. A lot of executives have gotten, you know, really washed out in 2014 when they continued buying on the way down. So by no means is it a bulletproof case, but when you look at things on an overall aggregated base, you look at supply, demand, inventories, the world, global sort of macro geopolitics, you look at these underlying factors, you look at who's buying oil, it gives you confidence in the trade, at least over a longer term period. You know, I love when people say, hey, oil is down this week. What happened to your thesis? And I go, 2020 was a fantastic year. 2021 was out of the park, life-changing. 2022 was phenomenal. And now you're going to judge me on a one-week drawdown in oil. And the funny thing is, again, just my perspective is, let's fast forward a year or two or three. The same people making jokes and comments now are the same people who have missed out the entire run-up on the other side of this. That's just the reality of the industry. You know, some people talk and some people walk the walk, and that is what it is.
For sure. There's been some activity in terms of M&A lately with Baytex acquiring Ranger. In your opinion, you can't predict the future, but what was your opinion on the deal? Are you in favor of M&A? Does it depend, or was it a good deal? What's your thoughts on the situation?
Yeah, probably one of the, call it more polarizing deals in recent times. There is a certain subset of the oil industry that just hates on every deal. They look at any M&A and they say, where's my dividend? Where's my buyback? You know, why are you buying other companies? Sort of mentality. And you know, really, there's companies that'll give you that. You know, there's companies in the Canadian patch paying 10 to 12% dividends. You don't need to go into these other companies if that's what you're looking for. You already have that. And not just one company, there's four or five I can name that are in that sort of, you know, 8 to 12%, let's say, dividend regime. So, you know, we'll leave the opinions of those people out, because they're unnecessarily taking on risk by going into other companies. So when I look at this deal, I say, okay, they bought it at a really nice cash flow multiple. Okay. They're buying a company in an area where they have some exposure to, with their Karnes County, DeWitt County, actually, I think it's Karnes County only, Eagleford. They're not the operator, so they don't necessarily have the operational expertise, but they know what's going on. So they bought it just to the east of that, which is fine. They bought it at a really nice cash flow multiple. They bought it with supposedly 12 to 15 years of inventory, which is not correct. They have maybe 3, 5, 7 years of inventory, you know, good quality inventory. I would suggest even less, because I've looked at Granger's Wells, and maybe I can get into this as I sort of go on. But the deal overall, whenever you're buying things at low cash flow multiples in a what I would say is the bullish market is coming, it's always a good deal. You can't go wrong buying stuff at 3x cash flow at an 80 WTI strip, because if oil prices go higher, if natural gas prices go higher, you're literally, you got the treasure chest that you bought at pennies on the dollar. So every deal that is being made right now in the last 24 months has been good. The question is, compared to Canadian assets that Baytex could have bought, is it a good deal? And I think the answer there is where it's no. They overpaid for a US acreage, a higher decline acreage, when, if you just zoom back a bit, why did Baytex not buy Crestwynd? Why did they not expand with Delta Stream in the Clearwater? Why are they not buying Headwater? Mm-hmm. You know, why are they not buying other stuff in their heavy oil properties, which are exceptionally high netbacks at these prices, or at higher prices, kind of 80, 90 WTI? So that's really where I start to question the company and where it's going. Now, the new CEO is American. They have American experience. It's not surprising that they went back into the Eagle Ford. Ranger also had a for sale sign, so it's not that surprising that they bought Ranger either. But really, could this deal end up being really good for Baytex? Sure. In a higher oil price environment, for sure. Could they have done better, I think, if they bought something in the heavy oil properties? I believe so as well. Is this deal going to impact Baytex share price no matter what? That also, I think the answer is yes, because there's been some phenomenal deals made over the last 12 months, which are showing their rewards now, but the share price is just stuck in mud. Exactly. Look at Tamarack Valley. Look at Whitecap. Look at where Surge was in 2021. That was these sorts of deals, massive deals, are just not helping share price right now. And Baytex management knew this. I mean, they're not stupid. They've seen the reaction to other companies making these sorts of deals that are really good, but just don't seem to reflect in the the share price going forward. So, you know, I would expect Baytex to be stuck money for 3, 6, 9, 12 months, given the size of the deal, given the fact that because the deal is so big, they will be unable to raise their dividend to any meaningful manner. They will be unable to do their buybacks to any meaningful manner over the next, you know, few months anyways. And the share price is just going to be stuck. So, I mean, I've gotten really, I wouldn't say good, but lucky maybe with an educated side to it at timing these things. Tamarack was maybe not a good example. But if you can buy these companies at the right time, when shareholder morale is at its very lowest, and that's usually 3 to 9 months after these deals, you see some selling pressure from the shares that were issued. They start getting dumped on the market. These deals can be really good opportunities at that point to buy into an accelerated sort of upward curve. And you don't have to time it properly every single time to the day. All you have to do is not get stuck in that quicksand sort of zone, which is why, you know, Baytex saw selling pressure, because I think other people realized this. They saw this happening in other companies and they realized this, and they say, hey, I'll just buy back in 6 months for possibly the same price, even if WTI rises. So that's where I think Baytex shareholders need to ask themselves the question that it's not if the deal is good or bad. Like, the deal is good. Is it as good as it could have been? No, but the deal still is good on an oil and gas cycle perspective. It just depends how long do you want to stay in this and wait for that churn to happen, or are you better off in other names going forward? So one quick comment on Ranger. They tried something different in late 2021, early 2022, where instead of drilling 7,000 foot laterals, they started drilling 9, 10, 11,000 foot laterals. And what they saw was a severe loss in well productivity per foot. And this is something, like I said, I've been away from the Twitter sphere for about 2 weeks now, so maybe somebody's already discussed this. But be very careful of acquisitions that report productivity on a per well basis. You never want to look at that. You want to look at productivity on a per lateral foot basis, because companies are trying to mask their productivity declines by drilling these longer and longer and longer horizontals that they produce the same oil or even more oil than the shorter laterals, but the well is 40% longer and it costs 40% more. So you're technically losing productivity, but they're not going to tell you that. They're going to expect you to find that out for yourself. Mm-hmm. So
right.
Ranger is a prime example. I can post the data on my feed at some point in time that they drill these longer laterals. They didn't get the right proper productivity from them. Yet they're going out and saying, oh, we drilled our best wells in this year, blah, blah, blah. Well, yeah, but the well costs 30% more and you use up 30% more of your acreage doing it. So is it really a better well? I would argue no. Hmm. So for sure, I would say any shale deal, even any deal in Canada, look for the productivity per foot and you will get a better idea of how good the acreage is compared to their peers.
The investor would gain an advantage by taking a long-term view by the sounds of it. If you can buy when the shares are selling off from the short-term fast money and take a longer view, that in the case of Baytex, it's to your advantage by the sounds of it.
Yes, yes, I believe so. Yeah, if you have a longer-term view, you can probably afford to sit tight. You can maybe afford to buy more shares. If you have a more, you have this in and out view on names where you think you can get outperformance by flipping in every 6 months or so, you know, maybe you can track Baytex and see when is there this extreme selling pressures and when they subside, you can then go and then, you know, start buying. So I'll just give you an example. In the case of Surge, what was done was we tracked how many new shares were issued. And then we track the number of excess volume over the average for the last, call it month or 6 months or a year, and then said, okay, this much excess shares is being traded every day. This is how many new shares were created. So the selling pressure should subside in late November, early December. Well, guess what happened? Surge was up 200% from December 24th to June 8th of 2022, right? You got 100% outperformance over the market just by looking at those things and timing your buys properly, because these shares can go down a lot more than people think mm-hmm. when that selling pressure comes in a low liquidity environment. And the difference between buying Baytex at $6 or $4.50 and where it goes to, the performance difference is absolutely massive as to where you end up at as the cycle sort of continues.
One thing I've been thinking about lately is that if you talk to anyone in energy, they think energy is good and they're bullish and that the things are going up and prices are rising and that everything's good. But that's kind of a risky way to think about things. How do you protect the downside or think of it in terms of risk on if you're wrong? Because when everyone agrees on something, it's always a good idea to think of it from the other side. What worries you these days in terms of the bullish energy case and what keeps you up at night?
Yeah, great question. So there's two things that can unravel a structural undersupply. One is more supply. So if there's suddenly more investment in supply, that okay, US shale has discovered a way to create more recovery factor out of their wells.
Yes, exactly.
That's what worries me. New technology, new enhanced oil recovery methods, new supply. Especially if that new supply can come online at call it a sub $50, $60, $70 break-even price, because we have supply. Like I could bring on 120 million barrels of worldwide production if you gave me $1,000 floor on oil for the next 20 years. I could do it. Mm. But the reality is we live in today's, you know, world and pricing. So any new supply that can happen at a lower break-even price is your number one thing as an oil bull to watch for. The second thing is a credit market event, and we're living through it right now, is that the credit markets don't care about the price of oil. When the paper markets need to get flushed out, they will get flushed out. Contracts will get dumped. It doesn't matter what's going on. When the boss man calls and says, hey, margin call, I need $300 million tomorrow, you got to sell whatever you got to sell. It doesn't matter mm-hmm. who you are. So the credit event is definitely a bigger becoming a bigger issue in the last couple of weeks to a month. And what drives the credit events is the federal funds rate, the global federal funds rate. And, you know, this to me, in the, what's happened in the last week or 10 days is a sign of two sides, because you saw what I would call a relatively mini credit event. You know, these are not huge banks. These are, you know, Silicon Valley Bank, First Republic Bank, local regional banks. Credit Suisse has been in the dumps for a decade at this point. So yeah, they've got a big book, but at the same time, they're not a very reliable bank per se for the last few years. So if this is all it takes to get the Fed to pause and even possibly reverse, I think we are in pretty good hands. But if the Fed sees this and says, no, inflation is still rising, we still need to keep hiking, I would get seriously concerned about a major credit event occurring. The banks are in much better shape than 2008. The consumer is in much better shape than 2008. We're not as leveraged. We're not as margined. But at the same time, when the credit events happen, it doesn't matter what data you pull up. Everything goes out the window. Everything gets sold. Exactly. So I'm using that as sort of my proxy to see what's going to happen. It's definitely what I've been having the most conversations about in the last week or so. The most messages are about the banks and what's going to happen. It is nice to see that each and every bank was backstopped by their respective, call it central banks, which gives the investor more confidence, I think, going forward. And then, you know, I think those really are the two things to watch. If you find any kinks in the armor, like major kinks in those two, it could be time to rethink your energy holding for sure, especially people who are on margin, because it can wipe you out way faster than anybody expects. So those are kind of the things that I would watch as my main factors. I'm still tracking every other supply demand metric. I don't think COVID or any new variant is a problem anymore. I thought that about a year ago, but of course, China has their own way of doing things. They don't really care what anybody else thinks. So we've gone through that now. I think the geopolitical risks are to the upside more than they are to the downside, especially if oil prices start going higher. You've seen historically when prices are higher, there's usually more violence and more geopolitical risk that comes into the market, simply because there's more money at stake. So when there's more money, people fight over it and there's issues. So those are the kind of things I'd watch. As far as downside protection, you know, I once again don't really have any downside. I really watch my data points daily. I watch my fundamentals daily. I try to keep an eye out on the pulse of the market as far as where the Fed and the overall credit market is. The one thing I would say that goes against all of this is that there is trillions of dollars that's already out of the market. So, you know, it's not like everybody and their dog is piled in on margin to the market anymore. There's, I think, $6 or $7 trillion in money market funds. There's a lot of cash in the market. There's a lot of people in the US that have that own their real estate outright. So there's less of a risk there. So there is mitigating factors that go against all of this, which is that if the market can find clarity and stability, which I'll once again highlight, this mini credit event could cause the Fed to create that stability going forward. What does an extra $6, $7, $8, $10, $15 trillion entering the market do to your oil and gas stocks, to your tech stocks, to your S&P, to your Dow Jones, right? And that's really why I keep stressing, think about what's already priced into the market. How many people are scared and are already sitting in cash, right? Some of these things have already occurred well before these events these credit events or whatever can occur. Always keep that in mind. It's not just what could go wrong. It's what could go wrong and is it already priced in to some extent? And that's a question each investor has to answer on their own. It's your subjective measure of risk and the reward that goes with it. For me, I'm looking at the screen today. I see WTI at $68 a barrel, and I see all the other factors that I see, and I can make a pretty strong case that, hey, you know, bullish from today's oil price is different than me being bullish if the price of oil today was $120 a barrel, right? There's a very, very, very different calculation and risk reward curve that can be created depending on where WTI is. So I would suggest every investor answer that on their own. And once again, saying that we're going into a recession is a problem and all this. Yeah, sure. If oil is 120, it's a problem. If oil is 68, is it a problem? I don't know. Maybe it's already priced in. So, I like to do within White Tundra is provide the data, is provide the charts, provide the information. And if people have different views on it, you know, then so be it. So I do think it's important to stay out of the bullish echo chamber. 100% agree with you there. I also think it's important to stay within the bullish echo chamber because a lot of people who don't invest in oil have no idea what they're talking about. They just put out random nonsense that makes no sense. So bias is good and bias is bad because it gives you good data, but you got to be careful not to fall into the abyss of that, which I think I myself have been guilty of at times in 2022. And probably will be guilty of going forward. It's just human nature. We are not robots. We don't analyze things on a strict data basis. We bring our own bias and emotion into things. The key is to regulate that to where it's helpful to you, as opposed to being scared of everything all the time, which I think a lot of investors are. They're just scared of everything all the time, and they let it affect their performance and they let it affect their mental health. So, you know, I would say it's a tough market. Nothing's going to be easy. We got lots of volatility. For me, being bullish at $68 a barrel is a very easy task compared to being bullish at a much higher price, given the kind of the macro and the data that I like to share as much as possible.
Well, I think that's a great conversation to get an update from you on the energy markets and whatnot. But this isn't financial advice. And like we said, you can't predict the future. But if you were to leave the listener, the investor, with a hint or some advice on where you're looking these days in terms of energy value, would it lie in the Canadian oil mid-cap names, or are you leaning towards gas, or where are you looking these days?
Yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head. The Canadian oil and gas mid-cap small to mid cap is my preferred way for sure. The reason, of course, is Canadian oil is a lower decline rate. We have more inventory. We have a relatively stable royalty regime. The Canadian dollar being where it is gives the Canadian producers an extra 35 to 40% boost on what they're getting. You know, some Canadian producers today are still getting $100 a barrel for their crude, $100 Canadian per barrel. So there's a big difference there. I think the inventory quality is a lot better, and we have better transparency around our industry. I think there's other parts of the world that are maybe misleading investors. They've misled investors for decades. Nothing's changed. It's just the nature of commodities where you can cherry pick data, and unless you have an engineering geologic background, you're not going to figure out that number is not really correct. So, you know, definitely my focus, I would also say focus on companies with tax pools. If you can buy a company that has 12, 18, 24 months of tax pool protection, you're naturally getting a company that's going to make 20 to 25% more free cash flow every single year for the next 2 years. And that gives them the massive advantage in terms of buying shares back while they're cheap, making acquisitions while they're cheap, you know, paying out massive dividends, and just gives you that money back faster going forward. So yeah, that would be my suggestion. And like I said, my portfolio is fully public on my website by percentage. So you can have a look at what I'm in, and happy to chat anytime. My email and my phone are always open. I could talk oil 24/7, 365. So please feel free.
Well, thank you very much. Like we said, if anyone wants to check out White Tundra, you can find all the info on your website. And I know you do weekly info sessions for anyone interested. So those are a public service, more or less. You do those for free if anyone wants to learn more. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks again, Trevor.
I really appreciate your time. We'll wrap it up there. Thanks for listening, everyone. Hopefully you enjoyed the episode. If you liked what you heard, check out rosebros.ca, where we will have upcoming shows. Until next time, happy coffee drinking.